Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Hello and welcome to Cutting the Curd, broadcasting on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Greg Blaze, and I'm here with co-host for the day, Patricia Katowska,
who's
Hi there, Patricia, who's a cheese and salumi buyer at Eataly. I'm here. I'm super glad you're here with us today at Roberta's and out of the office.
I'm so glad to be here.
We're joined today by Alex Brown, general manager and cheesemonger for Gourmet Imports in Los Angeles, who's in town for the Fancy Food Show. Thanks for making the trek out to Bushwick with us.
Oh, I'm very excited to be here.
It's awesome. How are you enjoying your time in New York so far?
It is, in a word, very moist.
Moist. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Kind of damp.
Absolutely.
And sticky.
Yeah, we have a dry heat where I come from.
Yeah, where are you from?
Well, I live in Los Angeles, but I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Oh, so sure.
Very, very much a desert boy.
Nice, nice. Yeah. I was just rewatching Breaking Bad, you know? Good stuff.
A lot of
whenever I want to feel good about myself, you know, I watch some Breaking Bad, and it, you know, makes me feel like at least I'm not a meth dealer. You know what I mean?
They get a lot right in that show.
Yeah, they do. So I wanted to ask you about cheesemongering and cheese culture in general. What have you seen as the main difference between the East and West Coast in terms of the culture, the counterculture, and just the cheese in general?
Good question. I mean, I think all of it could be summed up by just looking at it from the perspective of time. Obviously, like cities like New York, you have a much higher concentration of independent cheese counters, cheese importers, cheese producers in the state. And in a lot of ways, Los Angeles has been growing up for much longer. So like, when I started working in cheese about 13 years ago, I mean, there were maybe like four cheese counters in Los Angeles, and now it's closer to like 12, and it continues to grow. Same thing in San Francisco, although I feel like San Francisco follows.
They were a little different.
More. Yeah.
When I was out there for a little bit of time, 07 and 08, in L.A., there was Beverly Hills Cheese Shop. An Andrew's cheese shop, mm-hmm. and I think DTLA had just started up around that time, and that was about it. yeah. for in terms of who I sold to down there. But in San Fran, they had a healthier or a different kind of cheese culture.
Yeah, just much more established. And I think that, I mean, because of that, you know, the culture between the mongers and between businesses is much stronger. And I think that we're all enjoying a much more collaborative kind of air, you know, and that's really, really positive and special. And with production, I mean, same sort of thing. Like, I think that there've been cheesemakers in California for a long time,
yeah.
but the variety and the quality of what they're putting out is changing very quickly.
I also found the distribution to be, I am from New England, everything's small. You know, you can throw a rock from one end of the Massachusetts to the other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, California, especially, you know, L.A., San Fran are totally different. And it's hard to get cheese from the north to the south, or it was when I was working there.
Oh, totally. I mean, when I started, you know, being more involved in purchasing and things at the company that I work for, because I didn't come from cheese, I came from kitchens.
Uh-huh.
You know, the joke used to be, man, I can get a pallet from New Jersey cheaper than get a pallet from the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And it remains that way in different parts of the country, too, that just don't have the same supply lines established. But, distance makes a big difference.
Huge.
And it more and more so when it comes to, you know, if milk is traveling to be making
right.
the cheese, which is a great mystery of California.
Oh, it's a mystery. When you worked, Patricia, for Atalanta, you were sending, they had a warehouse out there when you worked for them. When did you work for Atalanta?
I started there in 2008, and so I did two internships there up until 2010. And yeah, they're pretty well established in Los Angeles. They're actually, they have many sales reps out there, and they, you know, sell all the wonderful gourmet imports from Italy and France and England, and they're pretty great to work with out there, from what I've heard.
Cool.
Other people.
You know, I think there's this idea of LA specifically being all about vegan food and going for food trends like, you know, gluten free. And what are your thoughts on that? Is that a myth or is that the reality of the situation? Because I'm going out there to help make a cheese counter, and these people have to eat milk.
Absolutely. Oh yeah. I mean, there's definitely all of those cultures are knit into one, but it's not, you know, in a funny way of kicking it back. It's like in a more kind of clearly a much more established cheese community, like in New York.
Sure.
I've heard of, you know, both mongers and producers being like, ooh, yeah, like I'm not going to be able to sell these Welsh rind cheeses in the summer. And hilariously in Los Angeles, because we don't have seasons, period.
Right.
people are buying washed rind cheeses no matter what time of the year it is. We don't have that kind of specificity of flow. But yeah, of course, there is also a 100% vegan cheese shop in Los Angeles, whoa. Which is very, very interesting. The man behind it is very charismatic. The product is weird and kind of gross.
What's nut cheese?
It's all nut cheese, but I'm fine with nut cheese in the spread sense. But when you're attempting doing traditional cheese making techniques
sure.
with nut cheese, it gets a little weird. Like spraying mold on like, you know, pureed
on nuts.
I don't know.
Yeah, nut cheese.
I don't know.
It's just, I feel weird saying it.
You should.
Would you like to buy some of my nut cheese?
No. Maybe.
Well, nice. That's great.
But the city's changed a lot. I mean, the food culture too. And there's a funny way that, you know, along with like people moving to Los Angeles from places like New York, places like San Francisco, to find more affordable housing.
Sure.
There's also like tons of restaurants that are coming. Like Jean Georges just opened up a place
right.
in Beverly Hills. Crazy. You know, you guys are coming out.
Oh, we are.
I think there's been this long evolution, I think, of the food culture in LA as you would know it in other cities. There's now all this crazy opportunity, which isn't to say that the people that are living there aren't doing a good job, but
oh no,
there's a lot of space to be filled. I think a lot of people are seeing that and moving accordingly.
Yeah. I'm always of the mindset that you shouldn't, you want to be a part of what already exists,
mm-hmm.
but I'm never afraid to challenge the established order of what people eat in terms of cheese and salumi. My whole life, I've been trying to convince people to eat spoiled milk, you know, things that smell to them horribly. You know, they're odd looking. The texture is not familiar to them. So I'm okay with it.
Totally.
It doesn't scare me, but you want to find that balance between what you want to make people feel comfortable and like you're not a UFO that's landed, you know, in their territory and just sort of, you know, pushing our alien philosophy and food on them. But by the same token, I'd like to be able to change people's minds about things like that.
Totally. Well, I think now, you know, 2017 and beyond is a great time to come to the city, and people are really voracious now for not only like new things, but also all the information. Like, I really feel that people are hungry to know not just like what it is, but like where it comes from and how it's made. And an adage that like I've always had with, I mean, most of my customers are chefs, right?
Sure.
But you have to think about your customers like goldfish. You keep a goldfish in a small bowl, it stays small. You put them in a bigger tank, it gets bigger.
Right.
So we have to always be pushing our boundaries.
I agree. We
have to always be teaching people about, well, maybe that cheese might scare the hell out of you, but just put it in your mouth and it'll be fine.
Do you think that the reasons why people are more interested in that is simply because the information is more available to them? Is it a fear-based thing, or is it a healthy sort of curiosity about where their food comes from?
I mean, I think all of the above. I think there's definitely much more education happening in both mass and, I guess, slightly less mass media, whatever we call that. You know, Michael Pollan, people that are like, you know, writing about food and writing about how, you know, things like cheese, like, are actually, it's more like medicine than something that's going to put you in the grave.
Totally.
But then there's also the thing that, I mean, I personally love to talk shit about. Oh, sorry.
For what?
You bleep?
Is that
okay?
Say whatever the hell you want.
Oh, perfect. I love to talk shit about food television, but at the same time, food television has totally captivated Americans and made everybody care so much more, I think, about
food. I agree.
So in the beginning, it was easy to snark out and be like, wah, 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 this isn't real. But now, I think it's really contributed to everybody supporting what we do and what we need to do for our producers. So,
agreed.
And if LA is like a big like media city, as it is,
right,
you know, then all the more reason why now it's becoming much more of a food city.
Food TV is an interesting, it's an interesting thing. Back when I was a kid, I used to watch Julia Child.
Me too.
And that inspired me quite a bit. I used to watch Walk with Jan, and the two large, they were, I think it was called like the two fat ladies or two fat, they were these, there were some crazy PBS food.
Frugal Gourmet.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And that was really helpful. And then we went through this Food Network, used to be Good Eats, mm-hmm, and Molto Mario, these kind of things. And then we were obsessed with, and we still are, with reality. So I think food TV became about watching people.
Competition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which wasn't as interesting to me.
No.
But now I think we're swinging back the other way. I've often been approached, or people have talked about, why isn't there a cheese-based food program on television? But I often found like it doesn't – cheese is so sensory.
Yeah.
And so it would be hard to translate. It would be – the travel aspect would be great because that's what everybody wants. They want to know, where do we get the good stuff?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that would work well, but you can't scratch and sniff your TV yet. Yeah.
And also, it would be weird watching a show watching people basically do dishes all day.
Yeah. Sure.
Which is what cheese making really is.
Totally.
90% doing dishes.
Yeah. A lot of cleaning, a lot of paperwork.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and that's, I think it's also a precious part of what we do still, that what we do is secret in this way, right? Mm-hmm. I think that there's
absolutely,
and I know that you guys feel the same way, and this happens. But like, whenever you tell somebody that you work in cheese, like, there's always this kind of like, really?
What's that all about, man?
What do you even do? Yeah. You know, there's great mystery and interest to it. Yeah, it's like, well, I manage humans and try not to lose money.
Absolutely. Sure. But you have to have that little P.T. Barnum aspect, because even if the box is empty, the thought that there might be something inside of it will keep people coming to pay a quarter to look at it.
Totally. Totally.
There was a Simpsons episode where Apu was Jasper was frozen in his he went in and froze himself because he wanted to see what the world was like later on. So Apu turned the Quickie Mart into this sort of museum of food oddities, and he had this can that had no label, and they were like, "Come take a look at this can. What's inside? The great mystery of this canned food, because the label is gone. You know, could it be olives? Maybe it's hearts of palm." And cheese definitely has that mystery. I like that.
Yeah.
Because there is some magic in cheese.
Absolutely.
100%.
Absolutely. Yeah. Even in like larger scale production, it just there is still it's
the
total
alchemy is there.
Yeah, yeah. It's real alchemy.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's part of the reason why I got into cheese. It was a mystery to me, and it was unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. The eating of it, it was around me, and I'm from the country, so the smells of the farm and like poop smells, things like that, I'm totally comfortable with all of that. Mm-hmm. It makes me happy to be around it, which says a lot about me.
Yeah.
But there's a little bit that I try to still keep for myself of those secrets.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I love gross stuff. I love it. But yeah, you can't tell everybody everything. You don't want to freak people out too much. But some people are really willing to go there with you. And I think that's also something.
Those are the people you hire.
Well, hopefully. Yeah. But that's also, I think, that kind of tactile connection that wouldn't translate to the television. You know, that's what's great about interactions at the counter, or like when you're working with the producer, even just with other cheese people, like there's kind of this visceral experiential element.
Before we go to break, that's what I wanted to ask you, that as a distributor, Patricia, you had experience as with distribution as well. Mm-hmm. Do you find that you work for a company that, I mean, obviously you get to interface with the product. But when I worked in distribution, I felt I lost a little bit of that, which I loved, which was just to be able to put my hands on the stuff and play with it. Would you agree?
For me, it was a little different because I was on the sales and marketing part of it. So I was touching product on a daily basis and sharing it with people. But no, I definitely have seen it just from other people that I've worked with who just don't get to touch the product as often anymore. And they're like, I'm just looking at Excel spreadsheets all day.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you know,
some people love that.
Some people are magicians at it. But, you know, at the end of the day, you still want to take home some cheese and have your bag smell like mine does. Right.
Yeah. And your entire body and all of your clothes.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that smell is very special. I mean, we have to be pretty hands-on, again, because we want and need to be. So I don't feel that I have any loss of, like, literal connection with the cheese. And in a way that I don't know is very common. I mean, I never worked in cheese retail officially. So when I started working for Gourmet Imports, I mean, I applied to be the secretary because I only had worked in kitchens since I was 14. I have a degree in philosophy, so I have no skills.
Great.
Other than flipping burgers. And I really wanted to learn how to use like a fax machine and like be able to be helpful in an office environment. So once... But our distribution was initially in the back of a shop.
Sure.
And so once I kind of got into it and got the bug, I kind of became the end of all questions that the retail customers would have. So I got to have that experience. But we have to like touch and prod the cheese for the chefs, because if we send them something that sucks,
that's it, coming back to you.
They're not shy about their feelings.
Cool. They shouldn't be. Well, we're going to take a little bit of a break, and then when we come back, I'm going to talk to you about your recent trip to Europe. Cool. Stick with us.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company. The operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm here with my co-host, Patricia, and our guest, Alex Brown of Gourmet Imports in L.A. Before the break, we were chatting about California and its food culture, food TV, and a whole bunch of other interesting stuff, how we all like to play with gross foods and smells, and that's why we're all here together. And in this part of the episode, I'd like to talk about your recent trip to Europe. You were there right before you came to New York City, correct?
Yeah, I was there with the owner of my company, my boss, and one of my other colleagues for a couple weeks in France, and then like a little jaunt into Switzerland.
Fantastic. What was the highlight of your trip?
Oh, so many. I got inducted into the Guild of Fromagers.
Oh, congratulations.
Which was very exciting. All three of us did all at once. And Rodolphe Lemonnier was our sponsor. It happened at his international cheese competition, the Mondial du Fromage and Tour.
Impressive.
And in his little introduction of us, he referred to us as the Three Musketeers of Cheese.
Fantastic.
Which stuck so intensely the rest of the time we were there. Everywhere we were, they're like, oh, look, it's this Three Musketeers. I don't know if I'm D'Artagnan or someone else, but it was pretty fun.
I've been referred to as the American. The nicest thing I think I was ever referred to, that I was traveling in the Jura Mountains for a different trip, they referred to me as the boy of cheese. So,
thanks, guys.
It's better than the alternative. I've been called a lot of not nice things too. So the boy of cheese worked for me.
That's fair.
And you visited. You were in probably in Jacquin, right?
Yeah. Went to see
Fromage Tremblay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Very, very, very incredible. And I have to say, like, I mean, I've worked with Jacquin's cheese for 13 years, and mm-hmm. I really assumed that when we walked into the plant that we were going to see all these machines.
Right.
No machines. No. Everything's very, very low tech. And something that we got really lucky and fortunate, Pascal Jacquin, the owner of the company, he gave us the tour, and he spent like 2 hours with us. He went really deep.
Passionate.
And apparently, at many times during their evolution and growth of the company, they've had the options to automate certain things, curd tumblers, things to flip the, you know, to flip the vats, all this
stuff. Packaging.
Everything, yeah.
Yeah.
And at every juncture, they've put it to the workers and say, like, do you want these improvements? Because ultimately, they're for you. and the workers keep saying, no, we want to maintain these, you know, these traditional gestures. I think they also probably don't want to get laid off by robots.
Yeah, but, hell no. No one does.
But it was pretty amazing to watch that production, how like efficient and magical it was.
They've gone through a lot of iterations of their product, and they've had a lot of touch and go situations. Their product used to all be raw,
yep.
And it would all come in with AOC labels on it. That's great stuff. That was in the 90s. That was what was available for French goat cheese and mm-hmm. Sèvres Belle from the Loire River Valley. Yep. If you were talking things that were, you know, legal and mm-hmm. supposed to be here. And it was great. It came in, and then I lost that cheese for a while. It just wasn't there. And then it came back, and instead of Crottin de Chavignol, they called it some odd name that I don't remember. And the cheese didn't sell, which I really found interesting. It was one of my first realizations of the power of naming and the AOC, why it exists, and the trust that people place in the names of those cheeses.
Weirdly enough, my boss, his mom, who started the company, she went to high school with Pascal, so she's
cool.
From very, very close to where the cheese is from, and we were hanging out with his cousins, and you know they got some cheese from the grocery store to like have as like an aperitif, and I mean the cheese is amazing, and it was raw milk. But interestingly enough, the Celsius-Share was an AOP Celsius-Share from Jacquin.
Right.
So even in France,
it from?
It was from Jacquin, but it had one of those like different names, like
yep.
like Rond de Cher or something like that.
Right, right.
Which really threw me for a loop. I was like, wait a minute, did they like put the American stuff in the case by mistake? But it was still Le Creux. Very weird. Huh. Very weird. But
I love all of the little. I think it's harder to. I could be wrong. The only all the Loire stuff that I've seen mm-hmm. has always been hands-on. Mm-hmm. You know, there's little molds. You know, it's little molds for Crottin. Yeah. So I think it may be. And again, I could be totally off base here, but I think the best stuff is always going to have that hand ladled quality.
Oh my God, yeah. And we had this. We went to Jacquin. We also went to Cloche d'Or.
Sure.
Who is that's a company that's, you know, been around for a long time,
yeah.
making goat's cheeses in the Loire Valley. And interestingly enough, you know, that's kind of like there's a deep familial connection between Cloche d'Or and Rodolphe Meunier.
Uh-huh.
But we also kind of like happened upon this farmstead Crottin producer. We like went to Sancerre just to like do the tourist thing for a minute. And at one of the wine caves, they're like, oh, you should go visit this farm.
Sure.
And these people, all they make is Crottin. All they make is raw milk, AOP, Crottin de Chavignol.
Those are so tasty.
They sell it at four ages. The shop that they sell out of is, you know, Jason the Farm's teeny tiny. And we went there totally unannounced, which generally makes me very nervous. But they were super welcoming, super sweet. And they basically talked to us for like 3 hours about their process, about the feed. Oh my God, the cheese was so good.
So did you
good.
Bring some back? Here's the question.
I didn't.
I ate it all.
I ate it all. We gave some to Rodolphe, and I've already paid overweight payments on two flights for packing my suitcase full of booze.
Been there. I love that. Cheesemakers are amazing people. Some of them aren't. Some of them just don't want you around, and I totally respect that.
Yeah.
But some really do. They really take a lot of pride in their work, and it's inspiring. Whenever you can, everybody always wants to get out of the house. They all want to travel. They want the tourism, you know.
Of course.
Which I understand on a certain level, but there's work to be done. As Emily and I, we always we did a show with our friend Jason Hines a little while ago, and it's still we've been building off of this show. It sort of spawned a seminar that we helped to teach for Lasa Skinner and the counterculture thing that she's doing.
Cool.
It tasks versus work. You know, tasks are all the shit you got to get done before you can start doing your work, which is to sell cheese. And everybody wants to travel and meet these people, which is ultimately it's very inspiring. But I feel like, you know, they skip steps sometimes to try to get there. It took me a long time before anybody let me out of the house.
Agreed. And it is a rare thing. I mean, I don't travel all the time. And doing it is wonderful, but it's also taxing.
It is. That's work.
Yeah.
That people ask me that when I am around people that aren't, which is rare, when I'm around people who aren't involved in cheese or involved in food, they always assume that. They're like, oh, you have the greatest job. You must just travel all the time. I'm like, oh, yeah, every day. I'm out there, you know. I frequent flyer. I'm in it, which isn't true. You know, like when I say I visited these farms, I visited these six farms, that wasn't six trips. That was like one day,
yeah.
Boom, yeah. 16 hours yeah. in a car, in with, you know.
It's much more like being, it's very similar actually being on tour. Like, if you've ever done that in a band where like.
I've never been on tour with a rock band.
It sounds.
Have you? Because I want to know about that.
I tour with my band like once every other year, but it's definitely not rock music. It's much more like ritualistic dungeon music. But
wow.
That pattern of travel is very similar, where it's like,
yeah,
you wake up. You drive 2 hours. You wake up early.
Oh,
drive
yes.
2 or 3 hours to the farm. You watch the process. Some of it's very thrilling. Some of it, as you said, is cleaning and watching a vat like turn into milk jello. Mm-hmm. Then more cleaning. Then you eat. Then you drive somewhere else. It's like it's all packed into one day.
Sure.
It's not like this like luxurious like jaunt in the field. Although there's some of that,
which is great. I mean. Yeah, it's all good, but it's work.
Yeah. My de facto response to the like, oh, do you travel all the time? How often do you go to Europe? And it's funny, my de facto answer is always, yeah, I do, but not as much as I'd like to.
Sure.
But in reality, that's not true. I think I travel just enough.
Absolutely.
I think like a couple, you know, food show conference trips a year, one big producer trip. That's a lot.
Yeah, it is.
And there's all the work that you're not doing while you're doing that work, too, mm-hmm. which will be fun to catch up on.
So you said you also you went into Switzerland for a minute? You went to Gormino?
Yeah, so the Gormino people, we've worked with them, I think, since they began. We've always bought our Gruyere and our Emmental from them. Love Joe.
Joe's amazing.
And we, unfortunately, Joe wasn't in Switzerland with us. We were hanging out with his bosses who, you know, happened to be quite nice. And we got to kind of watch the life cycle of the Gruyere that we buy from Michael Spieker.
That's cool.
So, you know, we got up to go bring the cows in to watch the morning milking. I attempted to milk a cow and kind of failed. And then watched the full cycle of production and then visited Michael's cave and then drove to the central affinage facility that they have in Lagnau, which was an old Emmental branch facility.
Right.
So more like modern cellars, like going deeper and deeper into the ground, like they have an elevator. And then we drove to Reichenbach and visited the new cellars that they're about to open, which are these converted military tunnels that are
totally
insane.
I love that these fortresses and these things that existed to defend against being killed or to kill, they're being repurposed into this wonderful spot where milk is being preserved. It's the exact opposite of the cycle.
It feels very very special to get to see that over and over again. And
yeah,
how wonderful would it be if just more and more military facilities like sublimate into affinage? That's so cool.
I would enjoy that.
I want some more of that to happen in this
sure.
country.
Let's make it happen.
Okay.
Maybe like a decommissioned aircraft carrier that just Ooh. Floats around in the Ooh. Ocean, and they can mature the cheese in the aircraft carrier. And then deliver it the same by the same token. You solve like 30 problems right there.
Get some oceanic terroir, some
right.
special brine.
Right, yes. And if we have to quickly you know, move cheese, we can just get some helicopters and bing, you're right there.
I like where this is going.
Good.
I like where this is going.
So if you come across any money, you and I can go in together. We'll buy an aircraft carrier and mature cheese on it.
Sounds perfect.
One
although
of those giant cargo planes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like a DC-10.
Yeah.
Just driving pallets in. Although I don't know that any of us are ever going to come across money working in cheese, but that's okay.
No, but we will be okay.
We picked the better fight.
We did.
We picked the better fight.
I'm not gonna let you end there either. That's we're going to talk a tiny bit more. You mentioned that you were with Rudolph in Tor. You were a judge in Mundial, right?
Yep. Yeah.
So we just had our CMI, our Cheesemonger Invitation, which is awesome. Our like Woodstock and cheese.
Yeah.
It's great. It's a awesome. Fantastic thing. What were the major differences, obviously, what you noticed in between the Mundial? And I'm not talking about the fun aspects and the festival aspects of it. What was the difference between, that contest and this one?
Well, I didn't get to see too much of the actual monger competition.
Uh-huh.
But my boss, Steve, he was a judge for the monger part, so I've heard a lot about the process. And though Rudy and Adam are like brothers and definitely both like to rage in equal measure.
Totally.
I feel that it's really interesting to see how like restrained and French, Mundial is. The monger competition's pretty serious.
Sure.
It's really serious. It's very quiet. It seems very stressful. And in some ways it's like, I mean, I know the mongers that competed, they're doing such a good job to like let their personalities like break
right.
through the ice of like, of assessment. But that's a big difference, I think, is that the procedural elements of it are much less like joyous and like vibrant, and it's a little bit more intense.
Do you think it has anything to do with the cultures involved? I mean, there are people from Japan competing.
Of course.
And,
it is international.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that probably everybody would want to have a little bit more fun for Dolph. But, I mean, there is a level of kind of, I think it mirrors the types of competitions that already exist in France. I mean, like the Meilleur Ouvrier de France competition, which
right.
Rudolph won. Those are really serious to the French people. It's like the Congressional Medal of Honor if you're an MOF.
Which is great.
Which is awesome. But
yeah. So what are, when you say it's a, there's elements of cheesemongery that cross all boundaries.
Of course.
You have to be able to handle the product.
Yes.
Whether you're at the CMI or Mundial or the big, big, big one.
Yep.
That Rudolph he won. I just wonder why it has to be stressful. I don't know.
It's more formal.
And I think it has a lot to do with educating the world about a certain market of cheese. So mm-hmm. the people from Japan are like, hey guys, we're here, we're competing, we take this seriously, we love cheese and we know about cheese, come buy cheese in Japan.
Okay.
So that's my
sure.
little token from that.
I think it's also the culture of the people that are doing the work. So if you look at like some of the people, not to say that like, the people from the Netherlands or the people from Japan even that are competing at Mundial don't like to party, because they do.
Everybody likes to party.
Everybody likes to party.
The more serious you look on the outside, the more insane you are when you cut loose, is my theory.
Absolutely. Yeah, the twinkle in your eyes shines a
right.
little bit brighter. But I will say, maybe I'm off here, but it seems like there's just much more of a, like, there's already much more of a counterculture, and I don't mean that in the terms of,
totally.
The cheese groups that we're talking about, but actual counterculture. There's more of a vein in that in American cheesemongery, I think, than in these other countries. And so the people that are, we're committing our lives to this, they tend to be a little bit more, a little bit more exciting in that way.
Well, I don't. My only issue ever, people seem to think, or maybe this is in my head. I mean, that's what motivates me sometimes. I have that chip on my shoulder because I've done this for a long time and I'm used to dealing with people. And it's less so than it was, say, in like the mid-90s.
Right.
But people are like, oh, you're an American and you do this? Like, you just must be full of shit. You couldn't possibly understand what it is to be this. And I don't think that that's the case at all.
No.
I think that Americans are, that we are also serious about what we choose to line up behind, very much so. And we have a lot of pride as a nation, and our citizens are encouraged to be prideful.
Absolutely.
of what they do. So I think that the perception is sometimes off, but I also think that everybody can use a little bit more enjoyment. You know, the French. Right. I love the French. You know, I have a lot of existentialist crises in my life. There are many times when I wake up and I'm like, you know, why am I even getting out of bed? You know, there's no, you know, if nothing means anything, then shit, I'm going to go work pantsless today, you know, or something, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. But I think that we bring an interesting element to the table.
Totally.
Of our passion.
Well, and I think there is, like, I mean, you know, not to make it about time or age or anything, but there is, like, for lack of a better term, a youthfulness that I think
yes.
the American scene brings to yeah. the cheese community, both in terms of production and in terms of mongering these competitions. And I think
right.
in this way, it's like maybe it's important, maybe it really is essential, frankly, that, like, you know, Rodolphe's event, which is truly amazing, and it's coordinating basically a cheese only food show focused on independent producers as much as possible. I think the entries have grown from like 100 to 600 or 100 to 300.
Amazing.
Wow. Also the cheese competition. So all the producers like at ACS are submitting cheese to be judged. Mm. And I got to do that, which was cool.
Yeah.
And this monger competition. So it's this crazy hat trick of work. And maybe it's essential that it has a little bit more of this, like, it's a little bit more highfalutin and intense. The stakes might be a little bit higher. But CMI stakes are high as shit, too. And it's also essential that it be this, like, joyous, raucous, like, thing. Because, well, I mean, I think that also speaks to who Adam is and what he wants to sort of imbue everybody's eyes with cheese. You know, not yeah. only the people that are in the community, the people that aren't in the community. So that yeah. they're excited about it. But I mean, both events are magical, and if you ever have a chance to get to tour, highly recommend it.
Definitely. I'll put it on my list. Well, same. I want to thank you so much for your time today, Alex, coming on in and just, you know, spending a little time with us in the shipping containers in Bushwick. And Patricia, you know, thanks for coming out of the office
yeah,
and hanging out with us.
Thank you for having me. This has been so much fun.
Cool. Well, stay tuned for more Cutting the Curd, and have yourselves a lovely day. Ciao, ciao.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.